This is the Personal Injury Update COE for February 2023, offered by the New York Appellate Digest. My name is Bruce Freeman. I'm the editor of the New York Appellate Digest. And this portion of the COE is based on the personal injury decisions that were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in February of 2023. The summaries of those decisions posted in February have been compiled into a report called the Personal Injury Reversal Report for February 2023, and it's that report that constitutes the written materials for this portion of the Personal Injury Update CLE. The first case in the February 2023 Reversal Report is Zakari on pages 3 and 4. The issue in this dog bite case was whether the defendant dog owner was entitled to summary judgment dismissing the complaint because the defendant did not know of the dog's vicious propensities. The two dissenters argued that there was no evidence the owner knew or should have known of the dog's vicious propensities, but the majority held a question of fact on that issue had been raised by the dog owner's statements that the dog was protective and didn't like coats. The plaintiff was wearing a coat when the dog attacked him. Those two statements, combined with the viciousness of the attack, were cited by the majority as sufficient to raise a question of fact about the dog owner's knowledge. The dissent explained the issues like this. Defendant's submissions in support of the motion, including the deposition testimony of defendant and the tenant, established that the dog was a gentle, well-behaved family dog who was not aggressive, menacing, or intimidating, was not a guard dog, and had never growled at, nipped, or bitten anyone before. Neither defendant nor the tenant had ever observed the dog exhibit any aggressive behavior in the past. In sum, defendant established that the dog had not previously behaved in a threatening or menacing manner. The majority nonetheless cites evidence in defendant's submissions that defendant and the tenant characterized the dog as protective and having a dislike of people wearing coats. But conspicuously absent from the majority's analysis is any explanation of how these characteristics reflect a propensity to do any act that might endanger the safety of the persons and property of others in a given situation. So the takeaway here is that it doesn't take much to raise a question of fact about a dog owner's knowledge of a dog's vicious propensities. Here, in the words of the majority, quote, "the unprovoked and vicious nature of the attack and the severity of the injuries sustained by plaintiff," end quote, combined with the defendant's statements that the dog was protective and didn't like coats, was deemed enough to deny defendant's motion for summary judgment. Next is Castano on page 5. We're in the February Personal Injury Reversal Report. Page 5. This Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6 case is here because of plaintiff's motion to amend the Bill of Particulars. Labor Law 241 Subdivision 6 causes of action are based upon allegations that specific provisions of the Industrial Code were violated by a defendant. Here, the plaintiff, after the note of issue had been filed, moved to add violations of the Industrial Code to the Bill of Particulars. Supreme Court denied the motion, and the Second Department reversed. The Second Department explained, Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying the plaintiff's cross motion pursuant to CPLR 3025 subdivision B for leave to amend the Bill of Particulars to allege certain additional violations of sections of the Industrial Code with regard to the Labor Law Section 241 subdivision 6 cause of action. The plaintiff made a showing of merit, and the proposed amendment did not prejudice the defendants and did not involve new factual allegations or raise new theories of liability. So the takeaway here is that adding the adding of industrial code violations to the bill of particulars after the note of issue had been filed did not involve new facts or new theories of liability. Therefore, there was no prejudice to the defendant. Next is Sanders on page 7. This case illustrates the relation back doctrine, which was invoked to add two physicians' assistants to this medical malpractice action after the statute of limitations had run. Supreme Court allowed the addition. The second department reversed. The physicians' assistants were not employees of the physicians named in the suit, so they were not united in interest with the defendant physicians, and plaintiff did not demonstrate that the physicians' assistants had timely notice of the suit. So two prongs of the relation back doctrine were not met. As the court explained it, in a negligence or malpractice action, the defenses available to two defendants will be identical, and thus their interests will be united only where one is vicariously liable for the acts of the other. As the physician's assistant defendants were employed by the practice, not the individual doctor defendants, there's no vicarious liability based on respondeat superior. The plaintiff failed to set forth sufficient facts to demonstrate that the physician's assistant defendants were directly supervised or controlled by the doctor defendants in their care and treatment of the decedent. The record is devoid of evidence that the PA defendants had noticed that an action had been commenced against the doctor defendants prior to the expiration in 2014 of the statute of limitations for the medical malpractice and wrongful death causes of action. So the takeaway here is that an employer-employee relationship which gives rise to the employer's vicarious liability for the actions of the employee supports a finding that the employer and employee are united in interest for purposes of the relation back doctrine. But here the physician's assistants were employed by the practice, not the individual defendant doctors. So the physician's assistants were not united in interest with the defendants. Next is Prezioso on pages 8 and 9 of the February 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is a medical malpractice and negligence action brought by an inmate in a county jail against a doctor who worked for the county, also against the county and the county sheriff. The case is included here because it illustrates that suing a county, county employees, and a county sheriff is best described as a can of worms or a trap for the unwary. The malpractice and negligence actions against the county-employed doctor were subject to the 1-year and 90-day statute of limitations in the general municipal law. Those causes of action were time-barred. The 42 U.S.C. 1983 civil rights causes of action against the doctor in the county were not time-barred and survived dismissal. The 42 U.S.C. 1983 civil rights cause of action against the sheriff should have been dismissed because the sheriff was not involved in the plaintiff's medical care. The relation back doctrine was improperly evoked for time-barred causes of action against the sheriff because the county and the sheriff are not united in interest. The county is not vicariously liable for the acts of the sheriff, and the sheriff's department does not have an identity separate from the county. The negligent investigation cause of action should have been dismissed because New York does not recognize it. Claims alleging the county was vicariously liable for the acts of the sheriff should have been dismissed because plaintiff did not allege there was a local law imposing such a responsibility. So the takeaway here is that suing a county and a county sheriff requires a lot of preliminary research to uncover the unique aspects of the suit, including the statute of limitations imposed by the general municipal law and the unique relationship between a county and a county sheriff. Next is Jaquin, pages 9 and 10 of the Personal Injury Report, Reversal Report for February 2023. This is a negligent supervision action against a school district. The unique question here was whether the school district could claim that its ability to supervise the physically disabled student was constrained by the student's 504 plan pursuant to the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's the ADA. The student was injured practicing jumps in gym class. The school district argued that the student's 504 plan under the ADA did not call for extra supervision. Therefore, providing extra supervision would constitute discrimination against the disabled student. Supreme Court agreed. The Third Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gary, disagreed, holding that a 504 plan does not operate as a ceiling for the supervision which a school can provide. As the court put it, a school district's written 504 plan does not operate as a supervision ceiling in all respects and circumstances. The central purpose of Section 504 is to assure that students with disabilities receive equal treatment in relation to their peers, that is, that they receive support based on their individual needs, so that they may also meaningfully access a given educational experience. This stands in stark contrast to defendants' reliance upon federal anti-discrimination law as a shield from liability. Plainly put, if two kindergartners have difficulty performing a skill in a mainstream physical education class, adequate support should be provided to both of them, not illogically only the one who does not have a 504 plan. Yet that is precisely what defendants' argument devolves to. So the takeaway here is that an Americans with Disability Act Section 504 plan for a physically disabled student which does not call for extra supervision does not justify a failure to provide adequate supervision when the situation requires it. Next is Sullivan on pages 12 and 13 of the February 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is a suit against the school district under the Child Victims Act. Plaintiff alleged she was abused by a school janitor. One of the causes of action alleged the school violated Social Services Law Section 413 because the school did not report the abuse. Supreme Court denied the motion to dismiss that cause of action, and the Second Department reversed. The Social Services Law reporting requirement only applies when the abuser is a person legally responsible for the child's care within the meaning of the Family Court Act. The janitor was not a person legally responsible for plaintiff's care. As the court explained it, the Supreme Court should have granted that branch of the defendant's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211 subdivision A7, to dismiss the third cause of action alleging a violation of Social Services Law Section 413. Since the janitor was not a person legally responsible for the plaintiff's care within the meaning of Family Court Act Section 1012 subdivision E, the defendants had no duty under Social Services Law Section 413 to report the alleged abuse of the plaintiff by the janitor. The result would be the same if a teacher were accused of the abuse. Next is Fenton, pages 13 and 14 of the February 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. The issue in this Child Victims Act case was whether the allegations stemming from 1982 and 1983 were sufficient to satisfy the pleading requirements of Court of Claims Act Section 11B. The Court of Claims held the so-called time-when allegations were not precise enough, but the Second Department reversed. The court explained, Court of Claims Act Section 11 Subdivision B places five specific substantive conditions upon the state's waiver of sovereign immunity by requiring the claim to specify 1, the nature of the claim, 2, the time when it arose, 3, the place where it arose, 4, the items of damage or injuries claimed to have been sustained, and 5, the total sum claimed. Under the particular circumstances of this case, the date ranges provided in the claim stating that the sexual abuse commenced in approximately 1982 and occurred repeatedly and multiple times from approximately 1982 to 1983 during periods when the claimant was directed to the workshop to receive counseling, along with other information contained in the claim, including that there was a criminal investigation, prosecution, and conviction of a man named West based upon the claimant's complaints of sexual abuse, were sufficient to satisfy the time when requirement of Court of Claims Act Section 11 Subdivision B. Next is Lobianco, which is on pages 14 and 15. This slip and fall turned on whether the defendant municipality had constructive notice of the condition. A grate over a storm drain had fallen to the bottom of the drain. Plaintiff stepped off the curb and fell into the storm drain. The photographs demonstrated the condition was apparent. When the defendant brings a motion for summary judgment in a slip and fall, it must demonstrate a lack of actual notice and a lack of constructive notice. A lack of constructive notice is demonstrated by proof the area of the fall was inspected close in time to the incident. Proof of the city's general inspection practices is not enough. As the court put it, while defendants submitted evidence that its employees generally maintain storm drains, including by cleaning them out and reporting missing grates, their submissions failed to establish when the storm drain into which plaintiff fell was last cleaned out or inspected. Next is Matter of Infinity Indemnity Insurance Company on page 18. The issue in this uninsured motorist traffic accident case was whether Supreme Court should have granted the petition for a stay of arbitration pending a framed issue hearing. In reversing Supreme Court's denial of the petition, the Second Court explained, the party seeking a stay of arbitration has the burden of showing the existence of sufficient evidentiary facts to establish a preliminary issue which would justify the stay. Thereafter, the burden shifts to the party opposing the stay to rebut the prima facie showing. Where a tribal issue of fact is raised, the Supreme Court, not the arbitrator, must determine it in a framed issue hearing, and the appropriate procedure under such circumstances is to temporarily stay arbitration pending a determination of the issue. In support of its position, Infinity submitted an affidavit from its investigator who stated that he found that a claim for property damage was previously made to GEICO arising out of the accident. In opposition, the appellants raised issues of facts as to whether GEICO's insured was involved in the accident. So the takeaway here, in the context of traffic accidents involving uninsured motorists, if there are preliminary tribal insurance coverage issues of fact, those issues of fact must be resolved by a court before the matter goes to arbitration in a so-called framed issue hearing. Next is Ann, that's A-N, versus Abate, pages 19 and 20. We're still in the February 2023 personal injury reversal report. The issue in this rear-end traffic accident case is whether defendant's submission of an affidavit from a witness claiming that the plaintiff was not stopped at the time of the collision, but in fact was backing up, required denial of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. Supreme Court denied plaintiff's motion, but the Second Department reversed. The allegation that plaintiff was backing up spoke only to plaintiff's comparative negligence, which does not defeat a motion for summary judgment. The court explained, the plaintiff submitted an affidavit in which he averred that his vehicle was at a full stop when it was struck in the rear by the defendant's vehicle. In opposition, the defendants failed to rebut the inference of negligence by providing a non-negligent explanation for the collision. The defendant submitted an affidavit, a witness to the accident, who stated that he saw the plaintiff's vehicle backing up while the defendant's vehicle was moving forward, and as a result, the front of defendant's vehicle made contact with the rear of the plaintiff's vehicle. The statement that the plaintiff's vehicle was backing up was insufficient to raise a triable issue of fact because that statement related only to the plaintiff's comparative fault. So the takeaway here, when a defendant runs into the back of a plaintiff's car, the defendant will be found negligent if defendant does not offer a non-negligent explanation. The allegation that the plaintiff's car was backing up at the time of the collision was not deemed to be a non-negligent explanation of the accident. Next is Bourdierre, that's B-O-U-R-D-I-E-R-D, pages 21 and 22. This traffic accident case raised the issue whether the police officer, whose name was Hughes, acted with reckless disregard for the safety of others when he made a U-turn to pursue someone and struck plaintiff's car. Supreme Court granted the city's motion for summary judgment, and the Second Department reversed. As the court explained it, the reckless disregard standard requires evidence that the actor has intentionally done an act of an unreasonable character in disregard of a known or obvious risk that was so great as to make it highly probable that harm would follow, and has done so with conscious indifference to the outcome. Hughes, that's the police officer, testified that after the offending vehicle passed him, he took his eyes off the road and looked into his left side mirror to see the offending vehicle's license plate number. When he resumed looking straight ahead, the plaintiff's vehicle was less than half a car length in front of him. Although Hughes testified that he applied the brakes once he saw the plaintiff's vehicle, the plaintiff testified that the collision occurred when Hughes turned sharply into the path of plaintiff's vehicle and then accelerated. Hughes did not activate his turn signal, lights, or siren before he started the U-turn. Defendant's submissions presented a triable issue of fact as to whether Hughes was reckless in attempting to make a U-turn without taking precautionary measures to avoid causing harm to others. So the takeaway here, this is a rare case when the issue was not whether the reckless disregard standard for emergency vehicles applied and precluded municipal liability. Here, the police officer's driving raised a triable question of fact whether the reckless disregard standard was violated. That concludes the portion of this personal injury update CLE that's based on the February 2023 personal injury reversal report. We're now moving to the March 2023 personal injury reversal report as the written materials. First case in the March 2023 personal injury reversal report is Sullivan on pages 4 and 5. This is a Child Victims Act case against a Catholic school. Plaintiff, a student at the time, alleged he was sent by the school off-premises to a priest for discipline and was abused by the priest. Supreme Court dismissed the negligent supervision and negligent failure to warn causes of action. The Second Department reversed, noting that the school could be liable for negligently sending the plaintiff off campus into a dangerous situation. Plaintiff alleged the school was aware of the priest's propensity to abuse children. The Second Department explained, the fact that the sexual abuse occurred off school premises does not require dismissal of the cause of action alleging negligent supervision, since here the plaintiff has alleged the defendant released the plaintiff into a potentially hazardous situation and directed him to see a certain priest for discipline, knowing that the priest had a propensity to sexually abuse children. The criminal intervention of a third party may be a reasonably foreseeable consequence of circumstances created by the defendant, for example, where, as here, the plaintiff was permitted to meet with the priest, a person who allegedly had a propensity to abuse children, alone and behind closed doors. Supreme Court erred in determining that the cause of action alleging negligent failure to warn was subject to dismissal because it was duplicative of the cause of action alleging negligent supervision. These causes of action are based on distinct facts, one based on failing to warn the plaintiff about the priest, and the other based on the defendant's failure to adequately supervise the plaintiff. So the takeaway here, a school's duty to supervise a student extends to where a student is released by the school and directed to see a third party off school premises for discipline. Here, the school's knowledge of the third party's propensity to abuse children speaks to the foreseeability of the abuse. Next is Wagner. On pages 5 and 6, we're now in the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is another Child Victims Act case, this time against a state psychiatric center in the Court of Claims. The issue here was whether the time when allegations in the Notice of Claim met the pleading criteria in Court of Claims Act Section 11. The Court of Claims dismissed the claim, holding that the exact date of the alleged abuse must be alleged, and the Second Department reversed. Second Department explained, the Court of Claims incorrectly determined that the claimant was required to allege the exact date on which the sexual abuse occurred. The claimant's allegations, including that the abuse occurred in 1993 while she was 14 years old and attending a gym class at Sagamore, were sufficient to satisfy the time when requirement of Court of Claims Act Section 11, Subdivision B. That's the end of that quotation from the case. Because the causes of action brought under the Child Victims Act occurred when the adult plaintiffs or claimants were children, courts are not holding plaintiffs to precise time when allegations. It's worth noting here that the claimant alleged abuse by an employee of the state. In addition to the negligence causes of action against the state, claimant alleged a cause of action to recover under respondeat superior vicarious liability. The Second Department noted that any abuse by the employee would be outside the scope of employment as a matter of law, precluding recovery under respondeat superior. Next is DG versus State, pages 6 and 7 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is another Child Victims Act case brought against the same state psychiatric center as in the last case. This time it was the claim, as opposed to the notice of claim, which the Court of Claims found insufficiently precise and the Second Department again reversed. The Second Department said, quote, the claim was sufficiently specific to satisfy the pleading requirements of Court of Claims Act Section 11, Subdivision B. The claim alleged negligent hiring, training, and supervision of an employee who had subjected the claimant to multiple sexual assaults between June 5, 2013 and September 16, 2013, a period of approximately 3 months, while the claimant was a patient. This is sufficiently specific to enable the state to investigate the claim promptly and ascertain its liability, end quote. So here the allegation that the claimant was subject to multiple assaults over a specified three-month period back in 2013 was deemed sufficient to meet the pleading requirements in the Court of Claims Act. Next is Youngia, Youngia, Lee, page 7 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This was a personal injury case where defendants defaulted and the plaintiff appeared at an inquest for damages. The judge dismissed the complaint, finding that plaintiff did not present credible evidence the accident occurred or that defendants injured her. The Second Department reversed because by defaulting, the defendants had admitted liability. The court explained, quote, by defaulting, the defendants admitted all traversable allegations in the complaint, including the basic allegation of liability. As such, the sole issue to be determined at the inquest was the extent of the damages sustained by plaintiff, and Supreme Court should not have considered issues of liability. End quote. So the takeaway, a defendant admits liability by defaulting. At the inquest, even if the plaintiff isn't credible, the defendant's liability cannot even be addressed. Next is Matter of Getting the Workout, pages 7 and 8 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This case involves a Freedom of Information Law request for medical records held by a state Olympic agency. The request sought information about injuries suffered by athletes at the Olympic facilities in the Adirondack Park. The Third Department explained that the HIPAA de-identification procedure should be used to remove any information in the medical records which would or could identify the injured athlete. The court wrote, the health-related information contained in the reports at issue is subject to the protections of both HIPAA and Public Officers Law Section 87. Specifically, the HIPAA privacy rule, among other things, addresses the use and disclosure of individually identifiable health information, which identifies the individual. Further, Public Officers Law Section 89 expressly provides for the protection of medical history, which refers to information that one would reasonably expect to be included as a relevant and material part of a proper medical history. End quote. So the takeaway here, if a FOIL request made of a government agency includes medical records, any information in the records which would or could identify the patient must be redacted. Next is MAPFRE, MAPFRE, pages 9 and 10 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is an insurance coverage case where the insurer sought a declaratory judgment. The injury was inflicted in a fight outside a bar. If the injury was inflicted intentionally, the incident would not be an accident and therefore would not be covered under the insurer's policy. Under that circumstance, the insurer would not be obligated to disclaim coverage. If, on the other hand, the injury was accidentally inflicted, to contest coverage, the insurer must unambiguously and timely disclaim coverage. Failure to disclaim would result in an obligation to defend. Next is DeVita, pages 10 and 11 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. One of the defendants in this labor law, Section 240 Subdivision 1 and Section 241 Subdivision 6 actions stemming from plaintiff's trip and fall over debris may have been liable as a statutory agent. A statutory agent is a party who has been delegated supervisory authority over a portion of the construction project. It apparently doesn't matter whether the agent actually exercised its supervisory authority. The court wrote, quote, as to Baring's liability under the labor law, it failed to establish that it is not a statutory agent for purposes of labor law sections 240 subdivision 1 or 241 subdivision 6. Baring's contract with Plaza delegated the authority to Baring to supervise and control the installation of kitchen equipment and obligated it to exercise such supervision over any of its subcontractors, such as the decedent's employer. That it may not have actually done so is not dispositive. End quote. So the takeaway here is that a party who is a statutory agent, I guess of the property owner, may be liable in a labor law, Section 240 Subdivision 1 or Section 241 Subdivision 6 action, even if it did not exercise the supervisory authority that was delegated to it. Next case is Reyes on pages 11-12 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. Here the plaintiff was not wearing a hard hat and was struck in the head by a piece of wood. Defendant's labor law 241 subdivision 6 liability turned on whether the job was a hard hat job within the meaning of the industrial code. Because the defendants did not demonstrate the job was not a hard hat job, their motion for summary judgment should have been denied. The court wrote, quote, Supreme Court should have denied those branches of the defendant's motion which were for summary judgment, dismissing so much of the labor law section 241 subdivision 6 cause of action as was predicated on a violation of 12 NYCRR section 23-1.8. In order to prevail on a labor law section 241 subdivision 6 cause of action premised upon a violation of that regulation, the plaintiff must establish that the job was a hard hat job, and the plaintiff's failure to wear a hard hat was a proximate cause of his or her injury. Here, the defendants failed to establish that the demolition work associated with house renovation was not a hard hat job, and that the plaintiff's lack of head protection did not play a role in the injuries he sustained when he was struck in the head by a piece of wood. End quote. The takeaway here is that to recover under Labor Law Section 241 Subdivision 6 for an industrial code hard hat violation, the plaintiff must prove it was a hard hat job and his injury was the result of not wearing one. Therefore, when a defendant moves for summary judgment on the issue, the defendant must affirmatively prove the job was not a hard hat job. The failure to do so requires the denial of defendant's motion for summary judgment. The next case is Brown on pages 12 and 13 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. Here, the First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Weber, joined the other three departments in holding that a negligent infliction of emotional distress cause of action need not be supported by extreme and outrageous conduct, which is a requirement for intentional infliction of emotional distress. In this case, a video camera had been installed in a hole in the wall behind a toilet in the women's restroom. There had been complaints about the hole in the wall. Supreme Court had dismissed the negligent infliction of emotional distress cause of action, and the First Department reinstated it. Next is Bessios, pages 13 and 14 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. In this slip and fall case, the issue was whether the lease which limited the landlord's liability for its own negligence violated the general municipal law. The general municipal law allows a lease to assign liability for a slip and fall to a tenant as long as the tenant is obligated to procure insurance which protects a potential plaintiff. Here, the lease did not include the insurance provision. The lease, therefore, violated the general municipal law. The court explained, parties to a lease agreement may execute a provision requiring the tenant to indemnify the landlord from the landlord's own negligence. However, the lease must also contain an insurance provision allocating the risk of liability to third parties, because courts do not, as a general matter, look unfavorably on agreements which, by requiring parties to carry insurance, afford protection to the public. When an indemnity clause is coupled with an insurance procurement provision, a tenant is obligated to indemnify the landlord for its share of liability, and such agreement does not exempt the landlord from liability to the plaintiff, but allocates the risk to a third party through insurance. Insurance procured by the tenant in satisfaction of the indemnity clause provides the injured plaintiff with adequate recourse for the damages suffered, end quote. So the takeaway here is a lease which assigns liability for a landlord's negligence to a tenant but does not require the tenant to procure insurance to protect a potential plaintiff violates the general municipal law. Next is Maharaj, page 15 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. This is another slip and fall case where the question is the liability of the landlord. Here, the landlord moved for summary judgment on the ground it was not responsible for snow removal at the leased premises, but the landlord did not submit the lease in support of the motion. Therefore, the landlord did not demonstrate it was an out-of-possession landlord and was not entitled to summary judgment. The court explained, the defendant's submissions failed to establish that they were out-of-possession landlords. The defendants did not submit a copy of any lease, and the deposition testimony submitted in support of the motion failed to establish, prima facie, that the defendants had transferred possession and control of the premises. Moreover, the deposition testimony submitted in support of the motion included testimony that the defendants were responsible for maintaining the property, including snow removal, and had engaged in snow removal on the premises. The defendants thus also failed to establish prima facie that they had no duty by contract or course of conduct to remove snow and ice from the premises. End quote. So the takeaway here, in a slip and fall case, where a landlord's maintenance responsibilities are controlled by the terms of a lease, the landlord's failure to submit the lease in support of its summary judgment motion will require denial of the motion. Next are Lakari, page 17, and Mara, page 18, two cases. We're still in the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. Both of these slip and fall cases were dismissed by Supreme Court and reinstated by the appellate courts, the third and the second departments. In one case, conflicting storm in progress evidence precluded summary judgment. In both cases, conflicting evidence of whether the ice on which plaintiff slipped was present before the storm precluded summary judgment. Next is Mo Salat, pages 18 and 19 of the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. The issue in this slip and fall case is what happens when there are two proximate causes for an accident, one ascribed to the plaintiff and one ascribed to the defendant. Plaintiff alleged her knee buckled when she stepped out of the shower. That was one proximate cause of her fall. Plaintiff also alleged she tried to catch her fall by grabbing the recently installed vanity, which moved 5 inches away from the wall, a second proximate cause of her fall, which raised a question of fact about the landlord's liability. Supreme Court had granted defendant landlord's motion for summary judgment, and the second department reversed. Next is Martin on page 20. We're still in the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. This is a rear-end collision case in which the defendant raised a non-negligent explanation for the collision. Absent a non-negligent explanation, the liability of the rear driver is pretty much automatic. Here, Supreme Court's denial of the rear driver's motion for summary judgment was reversed. As the court explained it, the PTM defendants submitted an affidavit from Merle, that's the driver of the PTM truck, which demonstrated that he had a non-negligent explanation for striking the rear of plaintiff's vehicle and that he acted reasonably when he was faced with an emergency situation not of his own making. According to Merle, that's the truck driver, prior to the accident, he was operating his vehicle behind another driver whose name was Acevedo. He was behind Acevedo's vehicle at a reasonable and safe distance. The plaintiff's vehicle, suddenly and without warning, cut in front of the truck driver's vehicle and seconds later struck the rear of Acevedo's vehicle and then came to a sudden stop. Due to traffic conditions, Merle, that's the truck driver, could not safely change lanes, and although he applied the brakes, he could not avoid colliding with the plaintiff's vehicle. End quote. So this is a fairly rare case where the rear driver in a rear-end collision case offered a non-negligent explanation for striking the rear of plaintiff's car and was entitled to summary judgment dismissing the complaint. Next is Countrywide, page 21 of the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. This is a no-fault insurance case where the no-fault insurance carrier requested that the medical provider submit to an examination under oath, called an EUO. The medical provider failed to appear for an examination under oath. The plaintiff carrier denied coverage and Supreme Court granted the carrier's motion for summary judgment. The first department reversed because the carrier did not submit objective justification for its request for the examination under oath, which is a prerequisite for a motion for summary judgment in this context. The court explained, quote, although plaintiff timely requested an examination under oath and subsequently issued a timely denial, the motion court erred in granting summary judgment. 11 NYCRR section 65-3.5 requires an examination under oath request be based upon application of objective standards and that the insurer must have a specific objective justification. Summary judgment is premature under CPLR 3212 where an insurer fails to provide a medical provider with its objective justification for requesting the examination under oath. This court has explained that the insurer's reason for the examination under oath is essential for medical providers to oppose an insurer's summary judgment motion and that information is in the exclusive knowledge of the insurer. End quote. So the takeaway here is that a no-fault carrier's request that a medical provider submit to an examination under oath must be accompanied by specific objective justification for the request. Absent that specific objective justification, summary judgment in favor of the carrier's denial of coverage is premature. At this point, I'm inserting a verification code for this February-March 2023 personal injury update CLE. The verification code is premature. Again, I'm inserting a verification code in this February-March 2023 personal injury update CLE. The verification code is premature. Next is Henry, pages 23 and 24 of the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. It's a traffic accident case in the Lincoln Tunnel. The Lincoln Tunnel runs between New York and New Jersey. Here, the traffic accident involved a New Jersey Transit Corporation bus and a New York resident. The accident occurred in New Jersey, and the trial was held in New York. On appeal, New Jersey raised sovereign immunity as a defense for the first time. New Jersey argued that the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case called Franchise Tax Board of California versus Hyatt, had changed the law in 2019 after the trial in this case, allowing a state to preclude suit in another state absent consent, thereby presenting a constitutional issue not subject to the preservation requirement. Here, the Court of Appeals rejected that argument and held the issue had not been preserved. The Court of Appeals wrote, quote, "The question before us is whether we have power to hear this appeal under New York Constitution Article 6 and CPLR 5601. To answer this threshold issue, we must consider the jurisdictional nature of interstate sovereign immunity to ascertain whether defendants' sovereign immunity defense is exempt from our general preservation rules. We conclude that a state must preserve its interstate sovereign immunity defense by raising it before the trial court, and no exception to the general preservation rule applies. Because defendants asserted their sovereign immunity defense for the first time on appeal after the United States Supreme Court decided Franchise Tax Board of California versus Hyatt, the argument is unpreserved in this case, and there is no directly involved constitutional question supporting this appeal as of right. The appeal, therefore, should be dismissed." Next is Davis, pages 23 and 24 of the March 2023 personal injury reversal report. This is a pedestrian traffic accident case. The plaintiff pedestrian violated the vehicle and traffic law by crossing the street where there was no crosswalk. Supreme Court granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment, but the Second Department reversed, finding there was a question of fact whether the defendant failed to see what she should have seen. The court explained, quote, "The defendant established her prima facie entitlement to judgment as a matter of law by submitting evidence that under the circumstances of this case, the plaintiff's own conduct in crossing the roadway outside of a crosswalk was the sole proximate cause of the accident, and that the defendant was not at fault in the happening of the accident. However, in opposition, the plaintiff raised a tribal issue of fact as to whether the defendant failed to exercise due care to avoid striking the plaintiff with her vehicle by failing to see that which is, through the proper use of her senses, she should have seen." And that's Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1146, Subdivision A. End quote. So the takeaway here is that the vehicle and traffic law requires a driver to see what should be seen, which is often raised as a valid defense, even where there is no question that the defendant was negligent. Next are two rear-end collision cases. Again, this is page 25 and 26 and 27 of the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report, the Obando case and the Genial case. That's O-B-A-N-D-O and G-E-N-A-O. These rear-end collision cases illustrate that the allegation the car in front suddenly stopped short is not enough to raise a question of fact. In both cases, Supreme Court denied the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, and the appellate court reversed. Next is the last case in this March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report, Reeves on page 26. This traffic accident case raises a proximate cause issue. Defendant Lopez's car was alleged to have been illegally parked. Plaintiff's car was in a collision which pushed plaintiff's car into Lopez's car. Supreme Court should have granted Lopez's motion for summary judgment. The fact that Lopez may have been illegally parked did not translate into liability because the location of his car was not a proximate cause of the accident. The court explained, quote, even assuming, as the plaintiff alleges, that Lopez's vehicle was parked in violation of applicable regulations, no triable issue of fact was raised as to whether the location of the parked vehicle was a proximate cause of the accident. Indeed, the plaintiff admitted in an affidavit that it was the impact of Wilson's vehicle striking his vehicle that caused his vehicle to come into contact with Lopez's vehicle. End quote. So the takeaway here is where there is a collision and plaintiff's car is pushed into a parked car, the parked car is not a proximate cause of the accident, even if it is illegally parked. And that finishes the discussion of the summaries in the March 2023 Personal Injury Reversal Report. And that concludes this February-March 2023 Personal Injury Update CLE course.